Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. My name is Keith Pannell, and today I'm here with a professor from the College of Pharmacy and Health Science at Texas Southern University in Houston. Well, this particular guest today is into what we will call nano drug delivery, and so it's going to be very interesting, and I'm glad you're here. I'm also glad that the guest today is Dr. Juan Shea from the same school, as I just told you, the Texas Southern University. And Juan, welcome to Science Studio.
Thanks, Keith. This is my first time to El Paso. I'm very glad to be here and also very glad to be on your Science Studio.
Jolly good. Well, it's going to be a lot of fun. So when I introduced your name and I said your name was Juan Shea, I thought all sorts of people are thinking, gosh, he must be from Mexico or he's some Latino. But no, Juan is H-U-A-N and Shea is X-I-E,
yes,
just to
correct.
Sort of put it in perspective, which means, of course, that you originally came from China.
Yes, Juan in Chinese actually means the universe, so it's a big name.
Oh, my God, you've got lots to live up to.
I do. I think my parents did give me a lot of, expectation as I grow up.
Well, tell us about growing up. When was it clear to you and your parents that with a name like universe, you were going to focus on one small aspect, and that is science?
Mm-hmm. Actually, I grew up in one of the biggest cities in China called Chongqing, which is along the Yangtze River. My family never have any scientists. We're good at mathematics, but just nobody has ever been a scientist. And I have been very good as a scientist ever since a kid, although I have a lot of other hobbies. But after getting to high school, I found science very interesting to me. And for me, the coolest thing is to be a female scientist. So that's I choose chemistry as my major when I went to Fudan University in Shanghai, which is one of the top universities in China.
How far away was that from where you lived?
It's far. Chongqing is at the middle part of Yangtze River, and Shanghai is at the top part of Yangtze River, so it's a long drive. So, yeah, I'm far away from my family, and I feel very cool to be away from the family as a teenager,
I understand that completely.
Yeah, and later I decide to come to North America, which is even further from the home. My parents never thought I would be a, doctor in philosophy, but I guess I pushed myself to that point.
Were they happy when you decided? Sometimes parents see their children and they go away, they get their bachelor's degree, and then they think, okay, now my daughter or my son is going to have a job or a career. And then you go home and say, no, I'm going to have a few more years in college. What was their response to that?
Actually, I think my parents to be the best kind of parents you can ever have. First of all, they're not pushing. They're not pushing me to do something I don't want to do. Second of all, they don't restrain me. So they let me to do whatever I like to do, in a good way.
Right.
Let me interject there,
because you hear so much about the Chinese mother dragon, the one that sort of pushes their children unmercifully to excel. That wasn't your experience.
My parents are not that way. They give me a lot of freedom. Because, as I said, I'm the first scientist. So when I actually go to Fudan University, they saw me already to be the best kid ever in the block, so they feel proud of me, and they don't know I want to do a doctor degree. But when I decide to do that in United States, they said, okay, we really like to stay in China, but if you really want to go, we'll support you 100%.
Well, that's very nice.
Yeah.
Did they come to visit you at all when you were in the U.S.?
They do.
So they saw how you were, where you were, et cetera.
Yeah. The first visit to me in North Carolina is back in 2004. That's when I graduate from North Carolina State University with my chemistry degree.
Lovely.
Yeah.
So the they were very proud then, and they came to your ceremony. So
yes.
You put on the gown and all the rest of it. That is lovely.
Yeah, it's lovely. Yeah, and I also get married on that year, so we did
married.
A lot of things on that year.
Did you marry someone that your parents knew?
They do not. I met my husband at the same university
right.
at North Carolina.
Right.
Yeah, he's a mathematician.
Is he from China also?
He's also from China.
All right. So you've got a common language.
Mandarin.
Right, mm-hmm. Lovely. Yeah. Well, anyway, so there you are. You came over all the way from Shanghai, North Carolina, a degree, a mm-hmm. husband, mm-hmm. and then you've got to find a job, right? Mm-hmm. And so then finally you landed up at Texas Southern University as a professor mm-hmm. in the College of Pharmacy. So that's a success story up to this point, right? Mm-hmm.
That's not my first job. My first job is at a small biotech company, also in Houston.
All right.
So I stayed about 3 to 4 years at the company. Then I decided to go back to academia. That's where I went.
What were you doing in this small company?
Research. I'm a senior research scientist doing gold nanoshells-based thermal ablation cancer therapy, which is in several clinical trials now.
So the point there, you have these nanoshells. Mm-hmm. Now, do you just put them specifically onto tumors and then irradiate so that they generate heat and kill the cell?
Oh, you know the whole story.
Well, so I don't know the whole story. I mean, I've done enough of
you
these
know
programs.
The ideas, right? So it's not we put them tumors. We actually inject them from the tail vein. Well, from the vein if it's a human. Then they will circulate, and part of them will accumulate a tumor. And later we'll do the laser therapy to heat up those particles.
Okay, but you're just doing the laser therapy on the tumor. So the rest of the gold particles mm-hmm. are in other places in the body where you would not want to activate them.
Normally, we wait at least 24 hours after we inject the particle. Okay. So majority of the particle are already cleared out from the blood system. Some of them in tumor. The other big part is in liver and spleen. So when we're doing the therapy, we are focused specifically on the tumor area.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And why did you leave that? I mean, that sounds like a pretty interesting area and full of potential for patenting and doing good things.
It was. It was very exciting because I'm doing some cutting-edge research. And later, because the company focus is all on the clinical trial, so they move more towards to paper preparation, you know what I mean? I scale up, you know, not on novel research anymore. So that's why I decided to move forward.
So let's continue with the thought process. Mm-hmm. Any tumor that the gold particles will attach to? I mean, just assume that for a horrible concept, I suppose, but you've mm-hmm. got a tumor, one part of the body and another tumor and another and a third tumor somewhere else, different types mm-hmm. of cancer tumors. Mm-hmm. Would the gold nanoparticles adhere to all of these, or do you have to have some special receptor on the gold particle in order to recognize a particular cancer?
Very good questions. I will say both. For the size or particle, they can accumulate tumors passively, which means through some effect called enhanced permeability and retention effect. So that means normal tissue and cancer tissue are different. Cancer tissue tends to have more leaky vascular. So when particle within a nanoparticle range, they can accumulate through those leaky vascular and go into the tumor cells, but not
so
to the normal
cells. It's the
cells.
Reverse of leaking, in a sense.
Exactly.
The cells leak, but mm-hmm. in that case, there's a reverse process, an adsorption of these nanoparticles.
Yeah, so they find some pores
right.
they can go, so they go there and stay there. This is one mechanism called passive or enhanced permeability and retention effect. Another way is, like you said, active targeting, which you put specific targeting molecules such as antibody or peptide on the surface of the gold nanoparticles and guide them to specific tumors which have the receptor for them.
Right.
For those antibody or targeting ligands.
So that's almost a specificity.
That's more specified targeting delivery. So both of the mechanism can be applied to the accumulation of nanoparticle in tumor, and that's how we actually let more particle get into the tumor. Yeah.
So your work then, presumably, if you were a chemist and doing experiments, mm-hmm. you were into the second part where you were coating the gold nanoparticles with particular proteins or whatever in order to do the specificity. Would that be correct?
You are Exactly correct. I also synthesize some of the golden nanoparticles.
All right.
Then we conjugate them with different ligands. And I also do laser therapy at the later stage. So I do the whole process.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the middle one.
Mm-hmm.
I understand, you know, you place receptor or the opposite of receptor molecules onto the gold nanoparticle. But then mm-hmm. you talk about putting them together, conjugating them with ligands. Well, I call that the ligand. What's the point of that? Is it the same idea that the ligand recognizes specific tumors? So it's all part of the same game.
Yeah. The ligand here refers to antibody or peptide, which is a homing or targeting molecules. So, yeah, that's the same concept.
And of the two technologies that are out there now, mm-hmm. you're the private company that you're with, and in general, a lot of mm-hmm. people, the very fact I know a little about it means it must be quite popular out there. Do you see that there's a home for both of these therapies in treating cancer, or is there clearly one is going to be superior to the other once we have developed it properly?
Are you talking about this therapy specifically all the therapy?
Well, I'm talking about the specific therapy where you coat the gold nanoparticle with something that recognizes the cancer mm-hmm, cell, mm-hmm. as opposed to the one where you put gold nanoparticles floating around mm-hmm. and then they get absorbed onto cancer cells. It would seem to me the first has got much more potential for success in the long run.
The general passive targeting, actually, will only have about 2-3% of the particle, injected particle, get into the tumor. That's why the targeting mechanism or targeting approach was more actively pursued by a lot of scientists. And there's some good data generate and prove, at least in animals, found a successful story on that. About the clinic trial, I'm not aware if that is already in clinic trial.
Okay.
But at least the passive targeting way is in clinic trial, but need to be improved.
I've just spent some time talking to people down at MD Anderson down
mm-hmm,
there in Houston.
Mm-hmm. My collaborator, one of my collaborators
yeah.
is at MD Anderson.
Because they are doing this implanting of gold nanoparticles mm-hmm. onto tumors.
Mm-hmm.
This is not just a haphazard expose them to a certain amount mm-hmm. of gold and some will stick. This is they go in and implant
mm-hmm.
the gold nanoparticles.
Implant, you mean directly into a
tumor
injection?
Right.
I
or
that
the
too.
Organ that's affected.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that seems to be another methodology for treating cancers.
Yeah, I actually, one of my side projects, I did study the comparison intratumor injection with intravenous injection to see which one, you know, is better. Of course, just by the concept, you know, intratumor injection will be having a lot of accumulation in tumor, a lot of more
right.
accumulation in tumor. But they also have some problem because when they do that, they have the particle not uniform occupied in tumor. So when you do the therapy, the laser therapy, you might end up with missing some
right.
of the particle. That's why the intratumor always not fully accept, but I do think it have a lot of potential if you're combining two of them together. That's why I think.
You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here with Dr. Juan Shea, and she's from the College of Pharmacy and Health Science at Texas Southern University in Houston. And we're talking about different concepts of treating cancers with gold nanoparticles coated with directionally useful molecules or just by themselves. We'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. David Neisel.
And I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog. Most of us don't see it happening yet, but exciting changes in medical care are bubbling beneath the surface.
Genomic medicine will one day provide people with unique treatment based entirely on their unique genomes.
Many major medical schools and hospitals already possess centers for genomic medicine. They've begun sequencing the genomes of patients, and in the case of cancer, their tumors, in order to map out a treatment plan.
This is possible because sequencing a human genome now costs just $2,000 to $4,000 and takes 1 to 3 days. Consider the first human genome sequence had cost $1 billion and 8 years to complete.
We now have more than 2,500 human genomes sequenced, representing 26 distinct human populations. So far, just these sequences show 100 million variations, proving just how unique that makes each of us, and thus our diseases.
In the case of cancer genomics, determining the DNA sequence of tumor cells may identify the cause and type of the cancer. Then the doctor could use the patient's genome to determine which drugs are most effective. This is called pharmacogenomics.
Genomic medicine is also allowing new non-invasive prenatal diagnosis. Scientists can sequence a fetus's genome from its DNA in the mother's blood, rather than using more invasive methods which are a risk to the baby.
While it appears genomic medicine is inevitable, one big challenge is insurance companies. How they treat these new advances could influence the medicine of the future.
We are Drs. David Niesel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Dr. Juan Shea from College of Pharmacy and Health Science, Texas Southern University. And we're continuing our conversation on the whole concept of nanodrug therapy. When one thinks about nanoparticles, drug delivery, et cetera, it's always gold. Gold is the first one that people think
about.
Gold
standard.
Right, I mean, the gold standard, right, exactly. However, what about other metals? I mean, do people do nanoparticle iron, being magnetic, for example, nanoparticle tungsten? I could go on. I mean, I know all these transition metals off by heart. Are there other useful metals out there that can be used for this type of therapy?
Of course. There's a silver, there, like you said, there are also irons. The irons are most used for their other function because they're magnetic particles,
right.
Not quite of the photothermal therapy. The reason we use gold as gold standard, golden standard, is because they have very high extension coefficients. Let's make it unique. Different than other metals.
Tell the audience what you mean by that extinction coefficient.
Extinction coefficient means their absorbance is very high.
So when you irradiate, most of the radiation gets
can
impacted.
Can generate heat.
Right,
yeah.
And generates lots of energy.
Yeah.
Do you do work with silver?
No.
So because your whole research activity is on the gold?
Yes and no, because this gold nanoparticle-based cancer therapy is only a small portion of my research now. Since I moved to Texas Southern University, I focus a lot more on some other nanoformulation encapsulation of novel compounds, new drugs. Yeah.
Well, let's move on to that mm-hmm. then, okay? Because, you know, clearly that your beginning was on the whole concept of putting the nanoparticles where you would like them, giving them some energy, transferring the energy to the cell, mm-hmm. killing the cell, and mm-hmm. that would be a cancer survivor, I
mm-hmm.
suspect.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this new approach then of encapsulating small molecules or drug molecules, mm-hmm. talk a little about that.
A lot of compound, new discovery compound, they need to be form certain formulation to be actually used for clinic or pre-clinic because they have their own problem. Sometimes they are small molecules. Sometimes they are very hydrophobic. So if a patient directly use them, it probably never get to...
just not soluble in the blood.
Yeah, it's just not soluble, but probably precipitate right away. So that's why it's very important to develop proper formulation to drugs. Either it's oral formulation or parenteral, which means injectable formulation, or transdermal, or even implant. You have to find the right application of the drug and also the physical chemical property of the drug, then decide what formulation you want to develop.
By formulation, mm-hmm. if I understand correctly, we're mm-hmm. really talking about some form of modification of the drug, not necessarily structural, but in order to have a delivery system. I mean, that's the key feature. So
that's a key
how does
features.
A gold nanoparticle, which is not exactly soluble mm-hmm. in water, mm-hmm. how does that facilitate delivery?
They don't. This part of a research is not
okay,
with gonad particle anymore. I'm glad you asked so I can clarify. This is more like traditional drug formulation. Although we use some nano formulation, but it's not involved goat at this stitch.
What does it involve?
Involve lipsome or polymers or just pure solvents to get some useful formulations.
So what you're saying there is, I know there's a molecule called dimethyl sulfoxide. Everybody who tests drugs starts out by a DMSO.
Exactly. DMSO.
Right, on the basis that DMSO is a very powerful solvent for very many things, but it's also likes to be in water. All right,
yes.
There's a miscibility there. The implication is that the drug is somehow coated by some DMSO molecules that permit it to wander through the bloodstream and yet not precipitate out because the DMSO is still strongly attached to the drug. Mm-hmm. Is that the way it works, or am I just...
DMSO is a perfect or a very good candidate for solvent for a lot of small molecules because they have good solubility in DMSO. Take an example with a compound I studied with the UTR Paso very own Professor Mark Cox.
Okay.
He discovered a molecule called MJC13, a new novel compound. And I worked with him on that project to develop formulation for him. This compound only soluble in DMSO. So when I got that and get back to my lab, I found it's very water insoluble. Okay, the solubility is in the lower microgram per
mL. It's insoluble.
It's insoluble, basically. So it's no way you can inject them into the body because DMSO have some solubility, toxicity issue. If you want to use that as inject formulation, will never get approved. Okay, so we want to do something else to formulate this compound. And besides the DMSO, we tried a lot of different solvent and combination of the solvents. We call that co-solvent formulation. We tried over 40 of them, and finally we found a system which works better, which is including PEG-400 and TWIN-80.
So these are what we call polyethylene glycols.
Which
for the audience just means it's a large, it's like alcohol at both ends.
Yes.
But in the middle of these two alcoholic OHs, there are lots of CH2s and oxygens to give it both a hydrophobic and a hydrophilic environment. And so PEGs, as they call polyethylene glycols, are becoming very popular.
Very popular.
These days.
Yeah.
They have no deleterious effects to the people?
No, they are very...
Benign.
Yeah, they are very safe to use, and they protect a lot of nanoparticles. Even my goat nanoparticle have PEG on the surface.
Well, that's interesting because some of the listeners will know, especially the wine drinkers. In Austria, there was a time when they couldn't make good sweet white wine. They just didn't get enough sunshine. The grapes didn't ripen sufficiently. And then they used to artificially add, but they used to add ethylene glycol, which is just the antifreeze, right? And this apparently is quite sweet, but it's also pretty damn nasty, right? I mean, it's not healthy. It is... I don't know if the word toxic is completely correct. So the very short ethylene glycol, that's not very good for the human body. But as you get longer and longer, it becomes more and more benign, apparently.
You are absolutely right. The PEG toxicity is dependent on their length because it's a polymer, right? So the shorter the PEG, the more potentially toxicity they might have.
So it's funny how bits of information from one place come back.
What
particular disease are you sort of, is it all cancer still, or are you looking at many other types of disease for the drug delivery?
Cancer is a major targeting disease.
Right.
Of course, now since I studied different compound, different drugs, so it casually brought to infectious disease, but still cancer is the most focused disease.
Any particular type of cancer that this particular drug with the formulation of the PEG is aimed at?
This is prostate cancer drug.
Oh, it is? All right. Well, all the gentlemen out there should sort of pick up their ears. Is it being applied anywhere at clinical tests?
not clinic tests, but in our preclinic tests, in the what we did in with rats in my lab, we found it to dramatically slow down the growth of the prostate tumor.
And the rat is a good model for the human?
Yes, very good model for the human.
Because I've had programs where people say rats and mice are they're okay, but you'd be better off using voles or something like that. That's for more social problems, I must say. But the rat is presumably universally understood to be a good model for prostate cancer, for example.
Yes, it is.
So are you doing any interactions with the people at MD Anderson on this? They've got a big cancer center down there. Prostate cancer is a big one.
The prostate cancer one, I'm not. But the previous study was gold nanoparticle is in collaboration with MD Anderson, radio-oncology department.
Yeah. So basically, as I see this, then, you've moved from the nanoparticle now to facilitated solubility of drugs using PEGs. Are there any other drugs that you're working with from other research groups?
Yes, as I mentioned earlier, we also study some drug already existed on the market, but lack of proper formulation. Well, one of them is itraconazole, which is an antifungal drug, which is broadly used.
So that's for topical application?
Topical application, but, well, a lot of people, the formulation we have on the market now is oral formulation. They used to have intravenous injection, but because formulation have some toxic stabilizer in there, so it was banned in United States. So we developed some new formulation on itraconazole.
So do you get support for that type of work from the pharmaceutical companies that are making the drug?
My first grant ever got after I get into Texas Southern University is with Farmer Grant, which is a very prestigious grant from industry.
Right.
So I use that to start my research. Nowadays, I am looking more in NIH grants.
Right. Yeah. Science sometimes gets a bad rap because people who don't do science don't understand the jargon. I remember talking about global warming a few years ago where some people at the University of East Anglia talked about doing tricks to manipulate the data. And it's not a trick in the sense of subterfuge. It's just a clever way of being able to analyze the data. Now, things like that, people outside of science think, well, they think of someone like yourself working in drug delivery, but you're working initially with the pharmaceutical industry, and they tend to think, well, maybe the results that she gets will be skewed a little. Do you have to worry about that a little?
Actually, that's not my worry because I think I'm doing the very
right. But the perception is always there that if you get lots of funding from company X, right, and you're using their products, and you say, "Oh, X is wonderful."
You know what? It was a foundation, so it's not really from specific
company. Well, I got all that wrong, but that's quite usual. And we've come to the end of Science Studio, Juan. It's been a great pleasure to have you. We've been talking to Professor Juan Shea from the College of Pharmacy and Health Science at Texas Southern University. You've learned a lot about drug delivery, formulation, solubilization, and thank you so much for being here.
Thank you very much for the opportunity. Very nice to meet you.
And we will thank Norma Martinez, as we always thank Norma Martinez, for putting the program together. And we thank you, as always, you, the invisible audience that's out there. And keep listening. Bye-bye.